History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that really ought to be heard, and that's never going to happen unless we take the time to ask a few questions and listen to what comes back our way. Today I'm in Tracy, California, continuing our mission to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we sure learn a lot, don't we? We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. In Tracy, California, I'm joined by 92-year-old John Fitizoff, originally from San Francisco, California. And John, you grew up there with your brother, and your parents had immigrated to our country from Russia, is that right?
Russia. Yes, they came here in the early 1900s.
Did you hear some stories about that journey or why they came or how difficult it was for them?
Well, yeah, I mean, what happened is they came to the United States, and like people normally do, they always cluster around other Russians that came to the United States. So they came to a huge colony in San Francisco. Matter of fact, there were three churches of different denominations. There was the Malacan, the Bruhini, and the Baptist. And then out in the avenue, Geary Boulevard, there was another big colony of Russians, and that was the Pravoslavny. And I understand the church is still standing and had the onion domes on it, like the churches in Moscow. Yeah, so they settled there, and I was born there, and I wasn't going to die. I wound up with Tracy.
So growing up in a Russian colony, as you describe it, in San Francisco, you probably had most of your friends were Russian. You probably spoke Russian.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, I used to speak Russian fluently. But then I lost a lot of it because my mother passed away over 50 years ago. And so there was no communication. And just like anything else, you know, if you don't do it enough, you begin to lose it.
Well, what was that childhood like growing up? Did you and your brother kind of hang together?
No, he was 7 years older than I was, and he had different interests than me. I was playing with marbles and stuff like that, and he was interested in girls.
I imagine that San Francisco has changed a little bit in the last 90 years. What are the things you remember about that area then as a boy? I mean, you were there when they started building the Golden Gate Bridge, huh?
That's right. Yeah, I watched that. It was altogether different. It was a community. It was a Russian community, and they had all these mom-and-pop stores were all Russian. I mean, they were run by Russians. We never locked the doors on our house, you know, or people that had cars. They never locked their cars up or nothing. It was a whole different ball game than it is now. I mean, now you got to keep looking over the shoulder to see if there might be somebody ready to do a job on you, you know.
Did you and your family feel the effects of the Great Depression there, or not so much?
Oh, now you're getting into a real good subject, you know. I remember the Depression really, really, really well. My mother, that whole community was all Russian. And they had actually in San Francisco, they had, I think it was two Russian daily papers or three. But the two that I remember is the Novy Zara and the Novosti. And that was printed in Russian. They were daily papers. That tells you how many Russians, you know, that there were in San Francisco. And also, at that particular time, the communist recruiters were real heavy in San Francisco because of the Russian population. And they came around, they figured, well, you know, they'd knock on the door and you'd answer it and they'd say, can we speak to the head of the household? In those days, I was the man. The father would answer the door and he'd say, well, why don't you invite some people over your house? And if you do, we'll bring some ice cream and cookies. Now, when he said ice cream and cookies, my antenna went up because I was, I remember, eating oatmeal for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and these guys were going to come over with ice cream and cookies, so I started scouting the neighborhood to see which ones were going to have these presentations that the communists were going to get. So I have a real understanding and a real working of what the Communist Party intends for the United States, and I'm telling you, it's a sorry one, and they're right on target.
Well, and I guess I have to ask, too, your family was here in the States, but did you have relatives that were still back home under that Soviet regime?
Oh, yeah, we had some relatives that were back there, but you lose communications, you know.
But, you know, for most Americans, you know, World War II started December 7th, 1941, but you were probably aware of what was happening back in, you know, your parents' homeland.
Oh, yeah, there were still some of these old-timers, Russians that were came over, and that's when, after the war, things got a little hot and heavy between the Russians and America, and I went down to Los Angeles to a funeral, not another big, large community of Russians down in Los Angeles. I was invited over to Nashville, you know, they invite you over to their house to have a little borscht, you know. So, you know, these old-timers, they'd say, you know, they knew that, you know, I was at war and my brother was at war. And they said, you know, if we have a war with Russia, are you going to go fight Russia? Because you may have relatives. And I remember saying, well, I don't know. If they start shooting at me, I'm going to shoot back at them. So they weren't too happy with that.
Well, take me back to, let's say, the 30s and the start of the 1940s. So you're a young man turning into a teenager. Do you have ambitions, hopes and dreams, thoughts of, hey, when I grow up, here are the things I'm going to do with my life?
Yeah, you know, naturally you all had dreams, but I don't really remember. I was just busy growing up. The older I got, the more interested I got in girls. So I had a lot of dreams there.
What do you remember about December 7th? How did you find out that the Japanese had attacked at Pearl Harbor?
We were in Roosevelt Theater, and we came out of the show, and we heard people whooping down the street, you know, hollering Japanese, you know, attacked us. And, you know, I said, well, maybe a bunch of baloney, but when we finally got home and everybody, when they finally solidified the story, why, you know, that was it, man. I was ready to go.
How did things change in San Francisco after that? I mean, did your lives change, the way you had to go about your daily lives, things you had to do or watch out for?
No, it was, you know, there was a lot of work, and people were people. It was just, San Francisco is really a good city.
I've talked to people who were in that area at that time, and it sounds like there was some real concern for people living in San Francisco and the Bay Area at the time that the Japanese might attack there, that there might be an invasion or bombings there.
Oh, yeah, that got to be a real, you know, area where, you know, my wife was telling about her father, the sirens went off and they had a blackout, and her father was at those times there were street wardens, you know, to go around to see if the curtains were blacked out or anything, and he couldn't find his pants. By the time he found the fifth pair of pants, he got the all clear sign. Yeah, everybody was concerned, and as far as, like I say, Japanese, you know, you weren't sure. You didn't know, you know. All you saw on the papers is the atrocities that were being caused by a lot of the Japanese soldiers, especially like that stuff on Guadalcanal. There was a hollowed grounds, and I was there twice. You start talking to a Marine about, you know, boy, and he lowers his head. That's, like I say, sacred ground.
Well, and so you were just 15 when Pearl Harbor happened, but as you said, your brother was 7 years older. So I'm guessing he was involved in the war before you were.
Oh, yeah, and he was working at Bethlehem Steel, that's the shipyards there, and he got to be a specialist on riveting gun mounts. I understand, as the story goes, that this one foreman was on his back because they deferred him because of the specialty on the kind of work he was doing in the shipyards. And he was always on my brother's back. So one day He came to work and he handed his badge to his foreman. He says, here. And the foreman says, what are you doing? And he says, well, I just signed up to go in the Army. He said, I can't take, you know, this harassment anymore. So that's what he did. He went in the Army.
Was that hard for you to see him go overseas? Did you wonder if he was coming back?
No, hell no. I was going to go, baby. Give me a gun. Let's go. Yeah, it was, no, everybody was really charged up. Everybody had their batteries going. Everybody wanted to go. Matter of fact, I had a heck of a job persuading my mother to let me go into the Merchant Marine, because you can go to Merchant Marine, you know, when you're 17 years old, because they needed the Merchant Marine, because as Roosevelt knew, and he told them that when the war was coming to a close and they were working on a GI Bill, he'd tell them, whatever you do, be sure you put the Merchant Marine in that GI Bill. And after the war was over, they forgot all about us. And Roosevelt told him, he says, if without the Merchant Marine, he says, I doubt whether we would have been able to win the war, and if we did, it would have been a long one, because everything that they had in the Pacific and in the Atlantic, you had to have the ships to bring the men and materials. Everything from a toothpick to a tank had to move by ships. And that's why the Merchant Marine in World War II had the biggest kill rate in World War II. It was 1 in 26, and then came the Marine Corps with 1 in 34, and then up the ladder. But a lot of people didn't realize that.
Yeah, and within every branch of service, there are more dangerous jobs than others. But you're saying if you take each branch separately, the Army, Navy, Marines, Coast Guard, Army Air Corps at that time, and the Merchant Marines, that being in the Merchant Marines was the most dangerous branch of service you could have chosen.
Yeah, it was the Pacific where the numbers run up, because in the Atlantic, I mean, they can sink the ship, and most, just about everybody didn't make it. Once they were in the water, even if they got into a lifeboat, they'd freeze to death.
Why was that so important to you? Why were you so determined to talk your mother into letting you sign up for the Merchant Marines?
Here's where the strange part of this whole story comes in. I kept telling my mother, I want to go over there and I want to meet Jim. I want to meet Jim. So sure enough, when we got over there and I met him.
Tell me the story. How'd you pull that off?
We pulled out of Australia with troops with their equipment and stuff. They were moving out of Australia, and because there were still Japanese on New Guinea. And this island, Goodenough, was just off the tip of that. It was just a little dot on the map. And so anyway, well, I got to meet him there in Goodenough Island.
There's a photograph, and I'll put this online at hometownheroesradio.com, of you two brothers. You've got your arm around him, and man, that's a baby face you're wearing there, just a teenager with your older brother. And that's on Goodenough Island, as you described. But you didn't know that you were going to find him there. Tell me how that unfolded.
Yeah, well, my mother signed up for me to join the Merchant Marine, got on the ship, took off, wound up in Australia, unloaded the stuff, and then we went up to a town. That's where they were camped up there, because Australia was the staging area for World War with the Japanese. So we picked up these troops and their equipment, and we were taking it up to the rest of his outfit. They were meeting up with him. I was walking on a deck, and there was a soldier there, and I said, boy, I said, I sure hope I can meet with my brother. And he says, what outfit was he with? And I said, well, it was, I think, Company B, 3rd Engineer, Combat Engineers, 24th Division. He says, hell, he says, that's our outfit. We're going to go up and meet him. And I says, wow, boy, this is something.
It would be something, and it wouldn't be the only time. But not all of them were under the happiest of circumstances. Hear about their reunions and how his brother earned the Purple Heart when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Some people see the challenge and say, send me. Some hear, it can't be done, and say, I'll do it. Some choose to stand for something bigger than us all. If you're ready to step forward and do your part, then you might be ready to become a soldier in the U.S. Army. It's a diverse team that works together, trains hard, and adapts every day to be ready for anything that comes next.
The U.S. Army turns soldiers into leaders capable of split-second decisions, extreme focus, and maximum endurance. These warriors lead their squads on missions armed with more than good intentions. They inspire their fellow soldiers to do better on and off the battlefield, making the Army a lethal and ready force. U.S. Army soldiers blaze a trail that leads to freedom. Do you have what it takes? Find your place on the team. Contact your local Army recruiter or visit goarmy.com/warriors.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 92-year-old John Fitisoff of Tracy, California. At age 17, he quit high school to join the Merchant Marine. He told his Russian immigrant mother at the time that he wanted to sign up so he could go find his older brother Jim, who was already serving in the Army. Their first reunion came at a place called Good Enough Island.
When we got there, I got one of the trucks that was unloading their stuff and taking it up to where the camp was to ask them to give me a lift up there to see my brothers. So we went up there, and I went to the tent that had its headquarters, and told them who I was, and I'd like to see my brother. I understand he was here. So the lieutenant told the sergeant, he says, take this fellow here over to Fedosov's tent. So we went over there, and the sergeant hollered out, Fedosov! And you can hear Jim back say, I wonder what I'm going to do, peel potatoes again? Yeah. So, yeah, what do you want? He says, you got a visitor. So he comes out there, like I say, where we saw each other. We didn't know whether to laugh or cry. But anyway, that was a reunion that I'll never forget. And so we turned around and left there, and I think it was a month later we came back to Good Enough Island. So I went to where their outfit was camped, and there was nothing there but a tent with a sign, headquarters. So I went over there and I asked him, I said, you know, I come here to see my brother. He said, yeah, we remember you. That was quite a deal, you know. He says, well, he's not here now. I said, well, boy, he says, I sure would have loved to have seen him. He said, well, wait a minute. So he took out a pad, and he wrote a note on that and everything, and he told me, here, take this and give this to the officer at the Australian jetty, and hey, they'll take you out to the ship that your brother's on. He's on a ship out there, anchored. So they, sure enough, they took me out there, and so I went aboard, so made my salute and everything, and the officer asked me what I want. I explained the story. So on the PA, Jim Fedosov, report to the gangplank. So sure enough, my brother shows up. He did a pee to the spats. So that was, we met a few minutes and talked, and because I had to get back to my ship. So I got back to my ship, and about, I don't know, whether it was 2 weeks later or maybe 3 weeks, I don't really recall. But that ship that he was on, he was going up to the invasion of Hollandia, New Guinea. See, New Guinea was split in half. The southern half was Australian mandate, and the northern half was the Dutch mandate. So this was the name of the village was Hollandia. So we pulled into Hollandia, and I find out that my brother's outfit had made the invasion on that on Hollandia. So after a bunch of inquiry, here I am. I'm on a truck going up to where the hell they were, you know. So again, he nearly peed in his pants. So he says, Fireball Jones or something, one of the guys, the first thing his outfit did when they pulled in, Fireball Jones, first thing he set up was a still. And so my brother got a little bottle of this stuff, and we celebrated. Oh, I made it back to the ship, still another miracle. But anyway, we got on the ship. You know, and so I mean, back. So that was three times now. And then there was actually a fourth time. The fourth time was we got notice that my brother was coming to Dibble Hospital. That was in Menlo Park. That's where they were bringing the wounded. And they told us, you know, just, you know, be a little bit careful, you know, on how you talk to him, because he right now, he had lost both eyes. He was close to another trooper that stepped on a mine or released a mine or whatever it was, and the dirt came up and it penetrated his chest and his face, and the dirt and the small rock penetrated his eyeball, so they had to take out his eyes, and they were going to work at putting those plastic eyeballs in his head. So he was really a character. He was a lot of fun to be with. You know, like when they brought him in and they set him down, they said, okay, Jim, now we're going to be working on your eyes. And what color eyes do you want? He says, how about a pair of blue ones and a pair of brown ones? And he says, what do you want that for? And the gray ones. He said, what do you want that for, Jim? He said, well, he says, when I wear my blue suit, I'll put on my blue eyeglasses. Yeah, and he went on. Yeah, but it was amazing, you know, after the war, what he was able to do. He had saws. He'd work on saws. He had a shop built in the back of his house where he had his tools. He had a lot of fun working on that stuff.
Well, a lot of things come to mind as you tell me that story. You know, it's interesting. I've heard so many stories about brothers in the war, and I've interviewed guys who they signed up because their brothers were POWs and they wanted to go back and rescue them, and maybe they did, maybe they didn't. Or my grandfather met up with his brother over there during the war who ended up getting wounded. So you've seen your brother three times already, and then you find out that he's been hit with this mine, with this shrapnel, that he's lost his eyes. How did you find that out?
The Red Cross or some government agency, you know, advised us that, you know, he was there in Dibble Hospital and that we could come and visit with him. And what it was, they flew him out of, like, in Guadalcanal. That was kind of the staging area for the wounded that came in there. And it was like a triage, you know, where some could good enough to go back by ship, and some of them could be repaired and put back on the front lines again, and other flew back. My brother, they flew him back by plane.
And you're still just a teenager, and here your only brother has lost both of his eyes in this war that you've been involved with too. How hard was that to wrap your brain around, or what were the emotions that stirred in you?
Well, I guess I thought I should have gone, you know, into a branch of the service where you can really mix it up with the enemy, you know, get some skin out of them. But that's all over with. That's another different story. I met a guy and talked to him, and he was in Japan, and he fell. They surrendered with the Japanese, and that he was in a death march and everything. We were talking about that, and we, you know, the enemy, and I didn't care too much for him. He says, well, you know, John, you know, let me explain something to you. He says, while we were in these prison camps, we were really treated really bad. He says, and as the war was moving more in our favor, they kept moving us up further and further towards Japan. And he says, we were in one of the islands in Japan, and all they had was a barbed wire fence, because where the hell are you going to go on an island in Japan? You can escape? And they gave them a little plot of land to work with to make their vegetables and grow their own vegetables. So he was by this barbed wire fence, and he heard this psst, psst, and he looked over. There was a Japanese woman that also had a garden that was grown on the other side of the barbed wire fence. And she moved over closer to the fence, and she motioned him over. So he moved over to her, and she lifted up her apron, and she pulled out some vegetables. I don't know. In other words, she gave him some food. Now, had the guard that was guarding the place, if he saw that, that would have been a dead woman. So he says, John, he says, not all people are bad. It's your leaders that are bad. And I never forgot that up until this day from what I see in Washington, D.C. going on.
Well, back to your brother. When you see a guy, and this is, you know, this is 1945. Technology isn't what it is today, and the accommodations for handicapped, disabled are not what they are today. So when you see a guy in his 20s, with no eyeballs, what did you think his future was going to be like?
So the last ship that I was out, they told Jim, okay, now we're going to send you to a center for the blind for rehab. And that's in Avon, Connecticut. So the last ship I was on, we went down to the Panama Canal. We came up the East Coast. We stopped at Wilmington, North Carolina, and we stopped in New York. And then we stopped in Boston. So I'm scratching my head. I said, Boston, I think that's somewhere pretty close to Connecticut. So I explained the whole story to the officer on my watch. He talked to the captain. So they got their heads together. And he says, okay, John, you can take a hike. Go to the bus depot and go to Avon, Connecticut. He says, it's not very far. So I did. So I got out of he didn't repeat his pants again. So I went and visited him again, and then I had to get back because I didn't know when the ship was going to be leaving. But anyway.
Well, let's talk about your experience in the Merchant Marines. The ships you were on, the duties you had, what it was like for you.
Well, it was, you know, just like anything on a merchant ship, you know. You never knew where you were going to go or where you're going to wind up at, you know, and you didn't know when a submarine might be around that you didn't want. And then like up in New Guinea, there were a lot of they were cleaning up the area, you know, with the Japanese. And they'd come over at night, the bombers, and they'd drop a few bombs. That's just to keep you awake. You know, but the real big one was, let me go back a little bit. I was on a ship where we went down to San Diego, and we picked up a lot of Marines, and we brought them over to Guadalcanal. But on the way to Guadalcanal, I noticed a lump under my arm. So I told the officer on my watch, see, that on these troop ships, they always had a area set up for medical, you know, because they had all these troops on that ship, yeah. So he talked to the doctors there, so they said, well, it's too early now. What we'll do is a couple of days before we get to Guadalcanal, we'll lance it, you know, and drain it off. So they did that, and anyway, then they tested my blood, and they said, this don't look too good. It even looks like it might have appendicitis. So they decided at that time, you better get them, we'll get them off the ship at Guadalcanal and put them in the hospital. You know, well, the hospital was a Quonset hut, you know, painted camouflage with a big red flag on the top of the Quonset hut. But inside it was painted nice and white. So anyway, they took me off that ship. I didn't have anything but my underwear. The guy didn't have a chance to get nothing together. Not my wallet. It was nothing. So they took me off the ship and they put me in the hospital in Guadalcanal. And like I say, that was where they were coming out of the front. And that was an experience in itself, just to see the way some of these boys were coming in, you know.
Tell me about that. Because most of us have never or will never experience anything like that. When you say how they were coming into the hospital, what were you seeing And how did you process that?
All you saw was stuff you didn't want to see, you know. I mean, who wants to see a lot of blood and a lot of people with body parts? The guy that was next to me in the bed, he was telling me he was on one of these Higgin boats, and he was, I forgot where they were, what invasion they were. Well, anyway, we were hitting towards the beach, and a piece of, a big chunk of shrap metal came between his legs and tore out the meat in both of his legs. But he says the important thing, he says, my family jewels are okay. The only good, let me tell you this, the only good thing that happened with World War II is that we won. Outside of the rest of it, it's all a bunch of, you know, misery. There's thousands of young men that'll never get married and have kids, you know. They're laying in a plot of land someplace in some foreign country. So anyway, I had the most respect in the world for them guys.
Well, and your brother came really close to adding to that number. He lost both of his eyes when that mine went off.
He belonged to the Blinded Veterans Association, and I used to take him to the meetings all the time. And you go one meeting, and they say, well, this guy committed suicide. And then they go, well, the guy isn't coming because he's off the deep end. He's drinking like hell. He's drunk all the time. And little by little, pretty soon, there was practically nobody left. They just couldn't take it.
And that's an issue that still plagues our country today with the men and women coming back from overseas, and something we should never forget about.
And one thing I will say is I admire our president when he's there to meet the plane and these coffins come off. I could almost cry right now just thinking about it.
Quite a variety of emotions John Fitizoff is stirring for us today, but we're not done yet. You can find photos and a short video of John online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And when we come back, we're going to hear what this teenage merchant mariner experienced at Okinawa in 1945. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Some people see the challenge and say, send me. Some hear, it can't be done, and say, I'll do it. Some choose to stand for something bigger than us all. If you're ready to step forward and do your part, then you might be ready to become a soldier in the U.S. Army. It's a diverse team that works together, trains hard, and adapts every day to be ready for anything that comes next. The U.S. Army turns soldiers into leaders capable of split-second decisions, extreme focus, and maximum endurance. These warriors lead their squads on missions armed with more than good intentions. They inspire their fellow soldiers to do better on and off the battlefield, making the Army a lethal and ready force. U.S. Army soldiers blaze a trail that leads to freedom. Do you have what it takes? Find your place on the team. Contact your local Army recruiter or visit goarmy.com/warriors. To talk to a local Army career counselor, call 559-323-1099.
Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is John Fitizoff, 92 years old, of Tracy, California. During World War II, he served in the U.S. Merchant Marine, and when we left off, the teenager was in a military hospital after a bout with appendicitis. So take me inside the brain of that teenager in this hospital on Guadalcanal. You're surrounded by these Marines who have awful injuries, missing limbs, physical, emotional, psychological wounds they're dealing with. What was going through your mind, and how long did you stay there in that hospital?
I was in that hospital for about 3 weeks, maybe about a month. As a matter of fact, one of the corpsmen over there was mopping the floors, you know, and he says, you look like you're good enough to give us a hand to, you know, give her a clean sweep fore and aft. And I said, look, if I'm well enough to sweep this place fore and aft, I'm ready to get the hell out of here and get another ship. So it wasn't a couple of days later. I didn't have no clothes. No clothes, nothing. They found a duffel bag on somebody that probably maybe didn't make it or whatever it was. So the clothes wasn't a good, what you call a good fit. So anyway, we made it through that deal finally. And then I hear on a PA system, you know, John Fedosov, report to so-and-so at headquarters. But anyway, I go there. The guy that was in charge, it was a Coast Guard. He told me, okay, he said, John, he says, we have a ship for you. I says, but I understand when I signed ship's articles that you were to get me back as fast as humanly possible to my ship, wherever it may be. He says, John, you're absolutely correct. But the only trouble is, if you think you're going to wait here for a ship to come here for us to put you out of, you might be standing on this beach for 20 years. I recommend strongly you take this ship we're getting you and get out of here. Then they took me out to the ship. I'm on the deck there, and I'm talking to one of the guys on the ship. So I'm telling you, and I noticed on the hatches, on these freighters over the hatches, they had cradles built to where they put the Higgin boats on there. So I look at that, and every hatch had one. It isn't adding up to me, you know, anything too hot, you know. So I'm telling the guy, I said, what'd you guys do? Oh, he says, an Espirito Santos. They came aboard and put these cradles on the ship over the hatches, and we don't know what the hell. So anyway, he says, you want to see something? He says, come here. So he goes over to one of the hatches that was still open to it, but we can look down into it. And I looked down in it, and everything in there was loaded in cargo nets. You know what they did is they came, brought the cargo in these cargo nets, dropped it in the hole. Now, whether they had little jitneys down there to pull the things, I don't know. But anyway, I know that hole was, you know, pretty well filled with war stuff. That meant they wanted to get it off the ship real quick. So then we're on the ship, and we're starting to pull anchor. And I noticed all the other ships around. There was a whole ton of ships. They were all pulling anchor, and they're all putting out to sea. And they finally formed the convoy. Now, I don't know. I don't remember them. 10,000 yards or whatever it was, forward and aft, port and starboard, where there was another ship. So we were on the deck, and we were sailing. I said, I'm going to go up and take a look, you know. So I climbed up the mast up to where the crow's nest was, and I looked out there, and it amazed me. I never knew they could amass so many ships at any one time. I came down, and I told the guys, we ought to go up there and take a look. You know, if I was some Japanese on a mountain to wherever we're going, and I saw this coming, man, I'm telling you, I'd find myself a wholesome place. Because it was huge and massive. And so early in the morning, dark morning, we dropped anchor, and we found out that the island that we were at was Okinawa. And the minute daylight came, that's when all hell broke loose. My battle station was right off the wing of the wheelhouse there. And what I understand why they did that was they took young kids that had good legs in case communications broke down. They could give you some orders to where you can take it to different parts of the ship. But it was, you know, I was watching these planes being shot then, and then all the guns on the ship were all firing, making all a lot of noise. It was a bad scene. We were there for about 11 or 12 days. The one that I still remember to this day is I was watching, you know, I had a box seat, you know, where my battle station was. I was up out on this wing, you know, and I could see pretty good. But then I got to realizing that usually the first place, these kumikaze, which were hot and heavy over there, That's one of the first places they fly into because it's a pretty big target, you know, and that's where the ship is being, you know, run by. But anyway, we were lucky there.
Well, I'm sure you saw a lot of that. If you talk about you having a box seat, you're seeing these kamikazes. You're seeing a whole lot of action in the air. What did that look like, and how nerve-wracking or frightening was that?
Well, I was watching this one plane. I could see him as he was, you know, on a downward pattern. And back there, in back of all the ships that were there, there was this Australian cruiser. He was there to more or less kind of protect some of the ships. And you can see that the Japanese plane, he was heading for him. And I'm saying to myself, my God, don't they see that guy, you know? Hey, why don't they fire or nothing, you know? I go, wow, this is going to... And just about that time, that whole side of that cruiser, all their guns lit up. I could almost swear that they stopped that plane midair, and there was all a lot of pieces that fell into the water. That kind of relieved some of the strain.
And what was that ship that you were on at that time?
The Clermont Victory. Yeah, that's thank God for the Clermont Victory, because I was able to go in the storeroom there, in the swap shop, or whatever they call it. You know, I was able to get some halfway decent clothes that fit.
This may sound like a dumb question, but I've got to ask it, because here you're a teenager out here in this incredible battle, and the biggest swarm of kamikazes that's ever occurred before, they're off Okinawa. Were you scared? Did you fear for your life?
Not really. There was so much to do, but we got so pooped that we were almost numb because we didn't really get any sleep at all. Because the minute you tried to bunk down or try to get a little snooze, the alarm went off. And everybody slept with their, they didn't sleep with their helmets on, but they were on the bed, by the head of the bed. But your life preserver, you slept with your life preserver when you can get a couple of 15, 20 minutes, because that alarm was constantly going off.
So you sleep with your life preserver because if your ship gets torpedoed or hit while you're sleeping, that way you're going to survive? Is that why you sleep with the life preserver?
Yeah, survival. You know, that's one of man's most important things is survival.
When you mentioned earlier, just kind of in passing, the threat of submarines, was that threat always hypothetical or did it ever materialize for you?
No, that was always on your mind. You never knew when or where. You know, you couldn't see them. You know, funny thing, I was over here at the Veterans of Foreign Wars Lodge over here in Tracy, and I passing by, I see a lot of cars there, so I stopped in. So they were having some kind of a get-together. So while we were in there talking, and one guy asked me, he says, what were you in? He says, I was in the Merchant Marine. Oh, he says, they didn't have any guns on them ships. Yeah, I don't know whether he was in the Navy or what. I said, no, I said, you're mistaken. I says, there was a 3-inch gun on the bow, 5-inch gun on the stern, and I believe it was 3 20-millimeters on the starboard and 3 20-millimeters on the port side. So we had all them guns on the ship. But what good are you standing on a ship and your ship is sinking and you can't see the sub to torpedo you? You know, what the hell good is them guns going to do you? Yeah. I said, that isn't important.
Did you guys ever have a close call with a sub?
No, not really. Thank God for that. The good Lord was with me all the way around with my brother and keeping me in a good, safe spot.
How about the weather? Did you ever have to sail through some typhoons or some really rocky seas?
Yeah, we did when we went through the Panama Canal and we were in the Caribbean. We caught the tail end of a storm, and I'm telling you, I wouldn't want to be in another one. All you did, you feet it when you were in your bunk, your feet would slide forward, you know, and hit the lockers that were down by your feet and hit another big wave, and then your head had hit the bulkhead, you know. So he's laughing back and forth, and you're not getting any sleep. You couldn't go out on deck. We had taken these 55-gallon drums that had paint or oil or whatever it was, and we took I think it was around a quarter inch or a half inch cable. We cabled them right to the bulkhead there or the side of the ship, that railing or whatever you want to call it. Two guys get on one end of the cable, the other guy get on the other cable, and the boat would pull tight as could be, and then they put these Crosby clamps on them. to where they can clamp the two cables together. So when it got safe to go out onto the deck, we took a look, and as much as we tried to secure those 55-gallon drums were gone.
So that's some pretty significant weather that wiped it clean like that.
Well, you'd be on the wheel, you know, and you're going along, you're steering the ship, and all of a sudden you feel yourself going up on a wave, and a person, the ship comes, boom, hit the water, and you count one, two, three, and tons of water would come all over the ship, you know.
How many ships did you end up serving on?
Four. Yeah, and that in the Merchant Marine, when you came back, like we were going 9 months and one day on the Mill and Griffith, that was the first ship. And when you came back to the States, you only had, I think it was 1 week, 7 days, to where you had to, if you weren't in, you know, on another ship, you got drafted. So it wasn't a case where you came home and you had a hell of a vacation.
The four ships you were on, were they all the same kind of ships, or were they different?
Yeah, they were all freighters. They were Liberty ships and Victory ships. Everything that moved had to move by ship. There were no highways. There were no railroad tracks. There was nothing but water. And the only way you're going to get that stuff is by ship. There was pretty near 1,000 ships. As strange as it sounds, there was pretty near 1,000 ships that were sunk. All I could say is when they told me, you know, that the war was over, I said, thank God. Thank God at last.
You know, and you mentioned earlier that your understanding that President Roosevelt wanted Merchant Marines included in the GI Bill. Of course, he was gone by the time the war ended, and you guys were not included. And it wasn't for another 40 years till they said, you guys are veterans.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt told Congress, you better put the Merchant Marine in the GI Bill and make them, you know, veterans. He said that without them, we'd have a hell of a time trying to win that war, because you can only get fly in so many people. You needed them ships. You need a lot of tonnage. So when he died, you know, Congress, they just completely forgot about us, you know. And then Harry Truman was going to give a letter, a thank you letter, to the Merchant Marine and a lapel pin. I never got mine, but these guys standing there with a piece of paper, you know, and a lapel pin, and they got the highest kill rate.
How angry did that make you that here you did serve your country and risk your life for your country, and you didn't get the same benefits that veterans from other services got?
It absolutely, really, I can't use the language on it, you know, but anyway, I am right up to this day, this minute, this second that we are sitting here, I'm so disappointed, really disappointed in our country on how they've neglected the Merchant Marine. We finally got our veteran status. The only reason we got the veteran status was three merchant seamen sued the federal government. So now they got veteran status. So then, you know, some of the politicians, you know, get a little weepy and the tears in their eyes. Oh, these wonderful men, you know, we're going to have to do something for them. So they sent a bill up, belated thank you to the Merchant Marine. And it passed the House of Representatives, except for one abstaining vote. Went up there to Harry Reid, and Harry Reid sat on it till dead. It's no longer around anything. Then, I don't know if she was House of Representatives or the Senate, she put a bill in there for the Merchant Marine for a one-time pension of $25,000, one time. Well, they're all dead, the Merchant Mariners. I'm the only dupe standing. I'm too stupid to die, you know. And here they are. I called up, and it was floating around, you know. I keep calling up because I think the merchant seamen are entitled to something, but they got absolutely nothing. I wanted to go back to school because I quit high school. So there was nothing there for me.
What did it mean to you when they finally said, hey, you guys from the Merchant Marines, you're veterans too? What did that mean to you?
About time. Here's something. Paul, did you know that the Merchant Marine had a hymn?
Heave ho, right?
Well, yeah, heave ho, my lads, heave ho. It's a long, long way to go. We can cross any ocean, cross any sea. Give us the goods and we'll deliver. Damn the submarine. We're the men of the merchant marine. They had their hymn. And every time I listen closely, like when they have the 4th of July or some military program in Washington, they'll play all the hymns, but never the merchant marine hymn. Never.
Well, one thing that's been neat, and I've got an application here for you. Maybe some of your friends here in Tracy have been on it, but you know, we have these honor flights to Washington, D.C. to see the World War II Memorial. And when they come back for Central Valley honor flight out of Fresno, when they land back at the airport and they come through the terminal and there's people there cheering for them, the band plays the Army, the Navy, the Marines, the Coast Guard, the Air Force, and the Merchant Marines. So if you go on that flight, you'll get to hear it when you come home.
I want to hear it all the time, all the time.
Well, if there's anything else you want to add, feel free, but I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. I'm sorry that that wasn't recognized the way it should have been for so long, but thank you for serving and thank you for telling us about it. Is there something that you'd say at age 92, almost 93, that you're most proud of or most thankful for?
The thing that I am most proud of is that I'm living in the United States. You know, we have our problems and we got a heck of a lot of them right now. And if anybody would just take and stop for a minute and think of all these young men in cemeteries all over the world are laying in that cold, cold ground for one reason and one reason only, and that was to make you safe here in the United States. And all I got to say to people who don't respect the country, respect the flag, I hope they have the sense to realize that this is a great country.
That is John Fitizoff, 92 years old, of Tracy, California. Find photos of John and his late brother Jim at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And in John's honor, the music you're hearing now is the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy Band performing Heave Ho as part of its Armed Forces Medley. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
Veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors. Some people see the challenge and say, send me. Some hear, it can't be done, and say, I'll do it. Some choose to stand for something bigger than us all. If you're ready to step forward and do your part, then you might be ready to become a soldier in the U.S. Army. It's a diverse team that works together, trains hard, and adapts every day to be ready for anything that comes next. The U.S. Army turns soldiers into leaders capable of split-second decisions, extreme focus, and maximum endurance. These warriors lead their squads on missions armed with more than good intentions. They inspire their fellow soldiers to do better on and off the battlefield, making the Army a lethal and ready force. U.S. Army soldiers blaze a trail that leads to freedom. Do you have what it takes? Find your place on the team. Contact your local Army recruiter or visit goarmy.com/warriors.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. but it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor. Here's a question I don't know if I've asked somebody before, but what was your favorite and your least favorite thing about life aboard ship?
Well, the least favorite was when we first started the sail and they'd have poker games. And these old-timers, they'd all get together. We'd green peak, and we'd get at the table, you know. We're sailors now, And these old-timers, they get the green peak, and they all gang up on them and get all this money. Then they take off. And then those were what I didn't like about it. But then when on the ship coming back home, we were playing dice, and I couldn't do anything wrong. That was the most wonderful part.